Accession number 9434, reel 11.
Mr. Bill Collins, reel 11. What other improvements were made to the trenches in this loose area?
Well, when we got there, it was just an earth flooring and very muddy, watery, and we were issued with thigh waders, thigh boots, to walk up and down them. But one night, they must have got busy very quickly in Quarry Alley, because the next day, when I went up about 11 in the morning to make my first morning inspection of the posts, the trenches, the bottoms had been cleaned out and duck boards put down right up to right up almost to the quarries. So and similarly, Hullock Alley, they did the same thing there, cleaned them out and put duck boards down. Very quickly. It was amazing how quickly they did that job.
Did they not fill up again with water?
No,
or
no. They dug a nice deep runaway underneath the duck boards, so that if there was any water, it lay down underneath the boards. They were very good and very easy to. You could take a man on a stretcher without any difficulty, and of course much more quickly.
Did they deepen the trenches at all?
They deepened them, yes. They put them about a foot lower down.
I believe they also made you a third. The Royal Engineers made you a third stretcher post. Could you tell me about
that?
Yes,
in Hullock Alley, we thought we needed another post, and a sergeant of REs scooped a third one out between the other two. Between them in the communication trench, and he completed it, and put a roof on, and after dusk, he asked his man with him. The sergeant had a man with him. He put him on top to fill it in with a spade. You know, just fill it in with earth, you see, before sandbagging it. But they got him. They had everything. Whether they had powerful night glasses or what, or whether it was a random shot, but they killed that poor fellow, filling the top in for me.
Now, so you had this third base. When we talked about your previous period near or in the line, we discussed the rations and supply. Had the nature of the rations changed at all? Were you getting more sophisticated foods than just bully beef, biscuits and that sort of thing? Were you getting cheese, bacon, anything like that?
We were getting cheese. And some tin jam, some of the famous plum and apple jam, but nothing like no bacon.
What about
bully beef, biscuits, cheese, and jam? That was our diet.
Did you get bread to go with the?
Yes, now and again. Yes, we got now and again. We got bread, but it was usually a lot of people in a loaf, about eight people in a loaf of bread, only meant about a slice each.
Did you go hungry in your time in the line here?
No, the rations were adequate.
What about water? Did you get enough water?
Water came up in petrol tins, you see. They came up from behind the line in the famous petrol tins. And it was all chlorinated. And what with the petrol tins and the chlorine, it wasn't very, the taste was a bit unusual for us.
Would you drink water from any other source while you're in the line?
No, not at all.
So you'd go thirsty rather than use shell hole water?
That's it, yes. And of course, to make a cup of tea, you had to put some water in the lid of your canteen, and put it over a candle flame. We had no such things as burners there to heat it up. At least I didn't, and I, my chaps didn't. And you had to put it over a candle flame, and it took about an hour to get it hot enough or near boiling to make a cup of tea.
Would you attempt to heat any of the other food?
No, none at all. The other food, although sometimes we had a treat in the form of a McConaughey ration, which was a tin meal of a stew, you see, a bit of stew with different vegetables, and it was very, very nice. If you could heat it, it was much better, but we had it cold.
Now, also, the sort of sanitary arrangements. Would you manage to keep yourself clean? I'm thinking because of the nature of your work and bandaging, it would be particularly important, perhaps, for you to keep your hands and self clean. Would you make a special effort at that?
Oh, yes, always. Oh, I did always, because, mind you, the stretcher bearers I had with me did no bandaging. They just carried the stretchers. I did whatever dressings were necessary to the casualties we had with through our hands and in the trench. And of course, before I'd got them, the regimental medical officer had bandaged them. So it was only the ones that sort of came between that I got. But I did the bandaging there. The stretcher bearers did no bandaging. They just did the carrying.
And how would you try and keep your hands clean?
Well, keep as possible with the, you know, what we had a buckets, canvas buckets to wash in, and it was not uncommon for about four or five men to use the same bucket full of water. Not uncommon.
Were these buckets supplied to everyone, or just to the medical?
Oh no, just we had one bucket at the dugout at the Invermells.
So there was at least an effort to try and keep reasonably clean.
There was an effort to try and keep clean.
Where were the latrines in this sector?
They would be in the trench. They used to cut a little annex off the trench, and put in a box latrine. So that they could bury it afterwards. And, of course, the one in Quarriere was, unfortunately, at trench level, and fellows who were a bit above average height found it a very unpleasant place to be, because that we lost two killed there while we were in the trench, just caught sitting on the loo, you see, and... they pushed their got their heads above the top of the sandbags surrounding this lavatory, and were killed.
Was it a noticeable difference, but that short men were better off than tall men, and vice?
Oh, definitely. Oh, I'm a short one. It was a matter of physique. The trenches were usually high enough to cover a man at 6 feet, but once a man got over 6 feet, he had to watch his head.
Right. Looking at some other things, in this time in the line, we've talked about lice, but did you have any problem with rats in this area? Was it a common pest?
No, not at all. Not there. I never saw a rat in the Vermels area.
What about, did you have any problem with the proximity of dead bodies, either buried or unburied? Going off, basically, and maggots and things like that. Was that sort of disgusting side of trench warfare, was it very evident in that area?
Not particularly, no. We had a bad case in the just above the hole in the ground in Vermels, where we had our aid post, where the feet of a French civilian were sticking up out of the ground when we went and occupied it. But the sanitary squad soon got him out and buried him out elsewhere.
So that there wasn't a problem. Was there a prevailing smell or typical smell of trench warfare that you could put your finger on?
No, not there, not in those trenches.
Now, you said it was very wet when you arrived.
Yes.
And did the cold and wet conditions of that winter of 1916, did they cause any problems for you?
Well, only the usual question of keeping warm. Of course, I think it was in February, we had a heavy snowfall, which lasted for about 5 days. And, of course, there wasn't a sound to be heard over the battlefield. Everyone had got their heads down, including the Germans. And we had 5 days of absolute peace. But when the thaw came, of course, business was resumed as usual.
Carry on.
And the usual, muddy road round Vermels Crossroads. It got very muddy there, but soon dried up when the wind, when the warm winds came.
How did you try and keep warm during the cold snap?
Well, the only thing was to keep into the shelters in the dugouts, and keep down in the hole in the ground at Vermelles. Keep out of the wind. You see, it's the wind that's cold. If you can get out of the wind, you're all right.
Would you use things like balaclava helmets, gloves, extra clothing? Would you resort to that?
Or? Yes, balaclava helmets were very useful. And, of course, we had our greatcoats and scarves, which most of the men had scarves, which their relatives had sent them from England, you see. But and gloves, of course, we had an issue of gloves, which kept our hands warm.
Now, with the wet conditions, you said before you used whale oil, or you'd had an issue of whale oil while you were in the Ypres sector. Yeah. Were you still regularly using whale oil to try?
No, I never saw any whale oil used after that first year at Ypres. I never saw it used, but I think it probably was, but we never used it.
Did you then have any problems with trench feet or frostbite-related illnesses?
Not with my unit, no.
Would people pass through your hands who had any things like trench fever?
Oh yes. The men sitting in the line were not so well off as we were, because we were on the move. But a man sitting in a trench is there, and he has very limited movement. And we had cases of men coming down with the temperature, and I noticed that the medical officer marked them all with the same letters: P-U-O, pyrexia of unknown origin. That was just a fever, you see. And they couldn't attribute it to any particular source, but of course it was the conditions, no doubt, that caused it.
So the symptoms were just standard fever symptoms?
Symptoms were standard symptoms of a fever. They all had temperatures. They all had temperatures around about 100, and of course they went down as casualties to hospital.
Would you treat them en route, or...?
No, not... The only treatment they had would be to get to have aspirin, 5 grains or 10 grains, 3 times a day while they were with us. But, of course, they were only with us half a day, you see. They were pushed away down to hospital.
What about other... was there an outbreak of dysentery ever while you were in this point?
No, not in this place, never.
Were there any other common ailments which you could say were caused by trenched life?
I can't say that there were. I think the number of troops who went sick was very small indeed. Very small.
What about things like colds and chills that perhaps you'd expect to get in the open air life like that?
Oh yes, cold. We had there were colds and chills, but then the soldier rode those. He rode those. He accepted them as part of the day's work.
So yeah. What about your own personal health during this 3 months? How was your health?
Oh, good. You see, I was 22 and strong, very strong. I was never sick or sorry.
And at this time, the problem with your left lung caused by gas hadn't become apparent?
No,
at all.
Not become apparent. You see, they didn't become apparent till later on.
Right. Now, we discussed a bit of your daily routine. You said you went round the posts. Originally, the first two, I suppose it was then the three stretcher posts. Yeah. What other daily routine would you have?
Well, the rest of my time was spent in the aid post, because you see, not only were we getting casualties from Quarry Alley and Hallock Alley, but they were trickling in from units to the side of us, on our flanks. We used to get the odd one or two trickling in, and of course they had to be attended to. Every I did some dressing there. If the doctor orders bandaging to be done, etc., or we changed the bandages, I did the dressing, and that's how my day went. You see, there was always something to do.
What would you when would you eat? Would you eat at set times, or would you just eat when you felt like it? Or would the medical officer say when it was eating time?
We ate when we felt like it. I did, and my chaps did the same. In their dugouts, they used to sit down and eat when they felt like it.
What about during the night? What was your routine during the night?
Well, during the night, every night I went round the posts after dark. And to make sure that they were alert and ready, of course, uncomfortable to use the trenches by day, all the supply work to the front line was done by night. For instance, timber, barbed wire. Everything, corrugated iron, everything that was wanted for the front line and for defences went up those communication trenches at night time in the dark. They couldn't go up in the... If they'd attempted to go in daylight, they'd have been shelled to blazes.
After you'd done your round, you just go around once. Would you then sleep, or how would you spend the rest of the evening?
The rest of the evening, it was the time I'd finished, it'd be about 9 or 10 o'clock, you see. So when I got back to the our hole in the ground at Vermels, I was ready for a bit of rest. Because I was up. There was always likelihood of casualties coming, and we used to get them in through the night sometimes.
And you just you'd be woken.
I'd be ready. You see, there I'd be on the spot. It was an all round the clock job. There was no doubt about that. I mean, you had to be. You were there and always liable to be called on.
You never had to go out. If there was a reconnaissance patrol or a fighting patrol, would any of your stretcher bearers be sent out into no man's land to receive casualties from even further forward?
Not in those trenches. There were other occasions during the war when that happened, but not in this particular sector.
So would the composite battalion's stretcher bearers deal with that?
As a matter of fact, I think there were only two occasions when there was a couple of raids by the chaps in the front line there, and they would deal with them. If there were casualties, they would deal with them until, of course, our chaps were alerted in their communication trenches posts, when they would go forward, you see, to meet them.
We've covered the accuracy of artillery fire, but how much artillery fire was there, and what sort of types of shells and that sort of thing were you getting at this time?
Well, there was only artillery fire if there was a target. You see, the Germans never fired unless we exposed ourselves. For instance, they used to watch. They used to watch the entrance. They could see us. Everyone going into the communication trenches. They could see at the entrance how many there were. You see, and when I used to go on my own, as I always did, to visit these posts, I never encountered any artillery fire. But when I went with, if I took another person with another a man or another sergeant with me, then they'd wait for us. To get into the trench about 50 yards, and then they would drop over a couple. They would put two right on top of you, so to speak. There was never any artillery fire unless it was invited, so to speak. Unless they saw you saw a clear target.
You gave us an example earlier of one of those incidents.
I gave an example earlier of that.
Could you tell the difference between different sorts of shells at this time? Would you know what a whiz bang was or a 5.9?
Well, the only shells they used on us in those communication trenches were the 77s or whiz bangs. They didn't use anything else. They were very high velocity shells, which came over and you had to be very, very quick to get on the ground.
Did you get the experience to know when a shell was coming close to you? Would you gain an experience in that way?
Oh, you'd gain an experience because the moment you heard the last whiz, you know, through the air, you were down flat on the boards at the bottom of the trench.
What about now? We mentioned briefly mortar fire. How far away were the German trenches at this point?
That I couldn't tell you for accuracy, but I should think they were about 200 yards.
So you were
not to a few yards.
So you would get mortar fire.
200 yards.
So you would get mortar fire at this time.
Oh yes, this yes.
Were there any different types that you identified? There's a toffee apple sort of bomb.
I never saw much in the way of mortar fire while I was there. Perhaps I wasn't quite close enough to get it. You see, they wouldn't waste a mortar fire on trenches other than the front line itself. They wouldn't waste them on anything farther back. Not even on the communication trenches.
Now, what about the general effect of rifle grenades, sniping and machine guns? Was there a lot of this going on, or was it, again, just at specific targets?
No, just at specific targets, so far as I was concerned.
Were you affected? Did your nerves start to be affected by being under fire of various sorts, or the risk of being under fire?
No, not at that stage. Not at that stage. No, I was... my nerves were as good as they could possibly be, and of course later in the war it was a different story. But at that stage I hadn't got to the point where my nerves were giving way. Although no, they were in very good condition in those days.
Were there any evidence? We talked about shell shock, but was there any evidence of self-inflicted wounds amongst the troops at this time?
No, not in that sector. Not at this time.
Now, I want to talk about how you got... We talked about how the RAMC got on with other troops. How did you get on with your medical officers?
Oh, very well. Very well indeed. Very well indeed. One of them said to me, "I don't know how you manage it," he says, "but you always greet me with a smile," he says. "To greet me with a smile in these trenches, I don't know what there is to smile about." He says, "You always greet me with a smile." I had a very easy disposition, you see.
What was the working relationship between you and them? Did you become almost friends in your working relationship, or was it very formalised, or how did it work?
Oh, it was one of great respect. You see, we knew the capabilities and the courage of the medical officers. I think they were almost a race apart. Throughout the war, they sustained casualties of a horrific nature. I mean, the medical officers who were killed during the war were the number was very large indeed, and I have nothing but praise and respect for them. They were all, of course, some of them were very highly qualified men who wanted to do a turn in the trenches to find out what life was like, you know, with the forward troops.
How would you address each other in the working situation?
Sir. Always sir. Always.
And would sir. They call you sergeant or...?
Yes, or Miss Sergeant or whatever it was, but they're always sir.
How did you get on with your stretcher bearers?
Very well. I was got on very well with mine. I was always fair with them. And, I mean, while they were sitting in those side dugouts waiting at work, they more or less did what they liked. They sat and they read and, you know, and chatted. And one fellow was a painter. And did I tell you this story before?
No.
A painter. And he whiled away one night in the quarry alley, sitting in the post there. He asked me, would I sit for him? And he sat and he painted a picture postcard size portrait of my head and shoulders. And the last time I saw it was in a billet we had behind the line. And I often wonder whether when the Germans occupied it in the Second World War, whether it was still being seen there, you see.
So
they were a mixed lot, you know, the stretcher bearers. They were all men of all trades and professions.
Did you have any trouble with any of them? Were they all equally reliable? Or?
Oh, they were all trustworthy. I never had any trouble with them at all.
Was your relationship with them essentially a formal one? Would they call you Sergeant, or would you be first name or second name terms?
No, it was always Sergeant, quite formal. You see, I was a regular soldier, and it was always Sergeant. There was no informality, not with regulars.
Did you have any special friends or acquaintances in the trenches that you relied on in particular?
No, none at all, no. I treated them all alike.
But I mean, did you have friends yourself amongst the sergeants, the other sergeants? Yes,
among the other sergeants, we were all very friendly. When we were out of the line, of course, we had a mess, and we were all very friendly.
Right. How long you were in the trenches up to March? Are there any other incidents you can remember which might illustrate the sort of life and that you were doing? You've covered a large number anyway.
Yeah, well, I don't think so. It was routine, you see. I mean, I went round down those posts. It was routine. I went round those posts three times a day, sometimes four. And when there was work to do, were casualties there, we treated them. And because the worst incident was the one which I mentioned, when the only casualty was the doctor.
Well, did you find this sort of routine boring? Or would it be boring over that length of time?
No, never, because there's always a chance that you might be seen and you'd get a whiz-bang down on your head. It was never boring. You see, I walked around them in the daytime, and I never saw another person when I was walking around. Everybody kept their heads well down in the daytime. It was only people like myself who would walk up and down those trenches in the daytime.
You said before you weren't much affected by the sight of casualties. Do you think ever during this period it became, or you went more further beyond that, and became almost callous to this sort of things, or
no,
it didn't affect you at all?
No, I was never callous. But I was cold, you know. I had a very cold temperament. Nothing would upset me. The worst wounds would not upset me. I looked at them as almost professionally. They were a job to be done. They were to be treated, you see. And I had no feelings at all of any kind, except to look after them and bandage them and treat them properly.
You say you were cold. Did you have a cold manner towards the patient, or were you just cold within yourself to what was happening?
Just cold within myself. Never cold towards the patients, but cold within myself, knowing that it was a job and I had to do it to the best of my ability and as helpful as possible to them.
Now, you said earlier you were in the line continually. Were you never pulled back during this 3 months for rest or to the reserve lines?
Oh, yes. We used to go out. We had a week out after every 3 weeks. I had a week out after 3 weeks.
What would you do during that week?
Well, I was at the headquarters in a village called Nulimine, just behind the line, you see, and I would rest.
Is that all you'd do?
That's all. I'd just rest. And then I would go back again to take up the Vermels post again.
So you wouldn't have any duties at Nulimines?
No, no, none at all, except the ordinary duties of a sergeant, you know, if there was a parade.
Would you get, what recreations would you have during a time at Nulimines? Would you be able to...
No, I'm just I used to walk and get exercise and walk. I was always anxious to keep very fit. I was very strong and very fit.
Would you visit, were there any estaminets nearby you could visit?
No, I never visit the estaminets. Obviously, I was not a drinker, I was a teetotaler.
So
the only drink I ever had was the Russian rum in the trenches.